Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the iPRO Surgical Care Improvement conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session with instructions following at that time. If anyone requires assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. And now, your host for today's conference, Ms. Denise Faulkner-Cameron. Denise, you may begin.
Thank you, Tyrone. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this, our fifth conference call for the Surgical Care Improvement Project Identified Participant Group. Today, we will be discussing the American College of Chest Physicians guideline, which is the primary source for the CMS recommended practice for preventing DVT and pulmonary embolism. Before we begin, I would like to give everyone an opportunity, if you haven't been able to access the materials for today's call, to go on to Jenny, our online community forum, which you will find at jenny.ipro.org. That's jeny.ipro.org, no www, and click on the forum entitled Breakout Room, and under that you'll find a sub-forum, Hospital Quality Improvement. Click on the link entitled Surgical Care Improvement Project. The password is Skyrocket, and you will find the first thread entitled the Skip IPG Conference Call Materials. The materials for the call include an agenda which outlines the format for the call, the presentation slides, and an evaluation form that we will remind everyone to complete upon the conclusion of the call. Leading this morning's discussion on the ACCP guidelines is our own medical director here at iPRO, Dr. Charles Stimler. Dr. Stimler has led numerous healthcare projects in New York and other states with a primary focus on reviewing performance measurement activities. He has also been actively involved in study design, providing technical assistance and training on quality improvement issues. At this time, I will turn the call over to Dr. Stimler.
Thank you very much, Denise, and good morning to everybody, and thanks for joining us. I'm going to go over unnecessarily briefly the ACCP guidelines, specifically as they apply to the CMS performance measures. This is a topic that sometimes gets a bit technical, but, you know, we are doing evidence-based medicine, so inevitably we have to explore the evidence in order to understand fully what, you know, we are supposed to be doing. I'm going to be following along on my slides, and if you can, turn to the first slide to start. The ACCP guidelines actually are quite comprehensive. They're hundreds and hundreds of pages long. They include reviews of the drugs used for anticoagulation, complications of therapy, prevention of VTE, which is really what we're going to be focusing in on today, the treatment of VTE, both through the use of antithrombotics as well as fibrinolytics, as well as a set of consensus statements on very specific clinical conditions, such as the use of anticoagulation in AFib, valvular heart disease, AMI, coronary artery disease, angioplasty, stroke, peripheral arterial occlusive disease, pregnancy, and children. So the ACCP guidelines really should be seen sort of as a Bible in a way. They're the kind of they're sort of a reference material that it's useful to go back to. Very difficult to really be an expert in knowing everything unless you clinically use this all the time. So we're focusing in today really on what is our concern, which is the prevention of venous thromboembolic disease, namely deep vein thrombosis and pulmonary embolus. Now, I don't have a basic science slide on this, but I'm hoping everyone here has the basic clinical knowledge to know that a deep vein thrombosis is a blood clot that forms in the vein of the leg or in a pelvic vein. It may be symptomatic, it may be asymptomatic. It can cause long-term local complications with impaired venous return, or it can cause a life-threatening complication if it were to break off the vein, travel to the heart, and lodge in either the pulmonary artery or one of the tributaries of the pulmonary artery, causing a pulmonary embolus. Our rationale for inpatient VTE prophylaxis is that most hospitalized patients have one or more risk factors for VTE, and these risk factors often cluster with each other. And actually, the ACCP guidelines really address all hospitalized patients, even the prevention one that we're talking today, although we're focusing mostly on the surgical aspects, they really do have recommendations for all hospitalized patients and point out the fact that probably most hospitalized patients should be on some form of VTE prophylaxis. Without prophylaxis, the incidence of hospital-acquired DVT is as high as 40%, even among general med-surg patients. 10% of hospital deaths are attributable to VTE, with the large majority of these being unanticipated VTE. These are kind of surprises. A lot of times you just find out at autopsy that the patient died of a VTE. Very often they just, you know, were not anticipated. What makes things even more difficult is that you can't really diagnose VTE reliably relying on just clinical signs and symptoms. So the usual looking for a swollen leg, edematous leg, a hot cord, some tenderness, calf tenderness, positive Hohmann sign, all of that in a way, it's important if you find it, but it goes out the window if you don't because many patients will not present classically. Pulmonary embolus is the most preventable cause of hospital death. It ranks number one on the AHRQ evidence list. So on the basis of the evidence, this is the largest preventable cause of death because VTE prophylaxis is highly effective. Just using it dramatically lowers the risk of all of these adverse outcomes. And further, these VTE prophylaxis approaches are safe. Systemic anticoagulation can be administered safely with little or no additional clinically significant bleeding. You may have some minor bleeding, but no clinically significant bleeding. So that makes for a very favorable benefit-to-risk ratio. So therefore, we should be anticoagulating or otherwise giving prophylaxis for VTE patients in the hospital. So how do we approach, what's our strategy to do this? And the guidelines discuss two general types of approaches. One would be individually assessing each and every patient carefully for each and every possible risk factor they have, looking at the importance of the risk factor, sort of giving it a weight, perhaps adding up all these risk factors, coming up with a total weight, and then on the basis of the total weight and the clinical scenario, sort of looking it up in a chart and figuring out which might be the best prophylaxis to use. This is a very individualized approach that the guidelines don't really recommend for routine use. This type of individualized approach tends to be cumbersome, very difficult and complex to practically implement, and has not really been validated well in clinical studies. Rather, they suggest a second method, which doesn't entirely ignore individual risk factors, but is more general and enables more rapid and less complex decisions to be made, and that is to look by groups, place the patient into a group category, and then look at some clinical factors to determine what type of prophylaxis is appropriate. In the case of surgical patients, we group by surgical category. Some of the examples here I've written, a trauma patient, total knee replacement, for example. Now, before I actually get into the guidelines, I just want to briefly mention the CMS performance measures. VTE1 surgery patients with recommended venous thromboembolism prophylaxis ordered. CMS is looking to see that at some time during the hospitalization, an order was written for an appropriate prophylaxis. The VTE2 indicators, looking to see whether the patient actually received the prophylaxis within a specific time period, starting 24 hours prior to surgery, going all the way through to 24 hours after closure time. The VTE 3 and 4 are outcome measures which we QIOs really haven't heard very much about, but we know at some point CMS is going to be looking at pulmonary embolus outcomes as well as deep vein thrombosis outcomes. Some general principles that the guidelines cover before we get into the individual recommendations have to do with mechanical prophylaxis, neuraxial anesthesia, laparoscopic surgery, and I'd like to go over a little bit of the evidence rating scale for the guidelines so that some of the stuff that follows makes sense. Mechanical prophylaxis is of two major types, passive and active. And in these slides and in the guidelines, passive usually mean graduated compression stockings, TED stockings, there are many synonyms. Active means that there's actually active compression going on, so you have intermittent pneumatic compression or other similar devices. Mechanical methods are less well studied than anticoagulation. They're just across the board. And they are felt to be less effective mainly because they have predominantly local effects rather than systemic effects. While forms of mechanical prophylaxis have been shown to decrease the rates of asymptomatic DVT, no type of mechanical prophylaxis has been shown to decrease the risk of pulmonary emboli or death. So that's part of the weakness of evidence that we have. They are, in practical use, used mostly for patients with a high risk of bleeding as a substitute for contraindicated therapies. The next sort of topic, neuraxial anesthesia, is important to both the guidelines and CMS. The reason for concern is that epidural anesthesia can rarely lead to a devastating complication known as perispinal hematoma. Patients who develop bleeding in the very limited spinal space can have the outcome of paralysis, even with a decompression laminectomy. So because of the severe outcome, it's of great concern to try to reduce the chance of such bleeding. When anticoagulation is used, this risk is increased. The times at highest risk are during insertion or removal of the catheter, especially a traumatic insertion, and the patients at highest risk are those who either have spinal deformities or anomalies so that there's more manipulation of the catheter, or have underlying hemostatic defects, or perhaps very high levels of anticoagulation or advanced age. The guidelines do recommend some best practices. They recommend that neuraxial anesthesia be avoided in high-risk, in patients with high risk for bleeding, or those with significantly impaired pre-op hemostasis. They do suggest that a pre-op anticoagulation is given to avoid insertion until 8 to 18 hours, basically until the effect of the anticoagulation is washed out, depending on the dose and the type of drug. If you get a bloody tap, if you've had a traumatic insertion, delay the anticoagulation because you clearly have a hemostatic defect. And even something that might seem so benign as removing the catheter has risks associated with it as well, because again, it is moving the connective tissue in the blood vessel, so that should be done at the anticoagulant drug level nadir, and one should wait 2 hours after, at least 2 hours. I know of hospitals that wait even 12 hours, but the guidelines say to wait at least 2 hours after the epidural catheter is removed before restarting the anticoagulation. Their formal recommendation is that in all patients undergoing neuraxial anesthesia or analgesia, we recommend special caution when using anticoagulant prophylaxis. Now, the way CMS deals with this question is they accept the fact that patients who are on epidural blocks may receive anticoagulation as per clinical judgment. If anticoagulation alone is decided upon, then it must still be, according to CMS, appropriate, and to pass VTE 2, it must be timely. However, recognizing the fact that there will be clinical settings in which providers will be hesitant to use anticoagulation, they also will accept any form of mechanical prophylaxis. So the use of a TED stocking or compression devices will be considered to be adequate regardless of surgery type if the patient is getting an epidural. And if that mechanical prophylaxis is given within the required period of time, the 24-hour before and after bracketed interval, then it will satisfy the VTE2 as well. Laparoscopic surgery is also treated as a special case. As we all know, it's increasingly being used these days. And most people who use them, most surgeons are giving anticoagulation with laparoscopic surgery, in many cases just as they would with regular surgery. And what makes it difficult as far as the evidence base is, therefore, there are very few studies looking at laparoscopic surgery without anticoagulation or trying to compare with and without anticoagulation. So we really have a shortage of evidence. The guidelines talk about two randomized trials that they felt had good methodology, which compared the use of placebo versus low molecular weight heparin and a passive mechanical versus passive mechanical plus low molecular weight heparin approach. And what they indicated was that regardless of what treatment the patient received, there were very, very low rates of VTE. So they don't feel there's sufficient evidence to really make a decision regarding giving prophylaxis on the basis of the evidence we've got currently. But note that the professional societies that advise surgeons with laparoscopic surgery do recommend anticoagulation or other methods. So that, for example, European Association for Endoscopic Surgery does recommend intraoperative IPC for prolonged laparoscopic procedures. And the Society of American Gastrointestinal Endoscopic Surgeons recommends the usual type of anticoagulation, you know, whatever the appropriate approach would be for a laparotomy type, do the same thing for laparoscopy surgery. However, ACCP considers that those recommendations do not have adequate evidence, and so they do not recommend the routine use. They, in fact, recommend against routine thromboprophylaxis and laparoscopic surgery other than aggressive mobilization, which is grade 1A. But they do say that patients who are undergoing laparoscopic procedures having additional VTE risk factors should get one or more of the following, and here they talk about the heparins, IPG, and graduated compression stockings. So how does CMS deal with this controversy? Because clearly there's some conflict in recommendations. CMS excludes all purely laparoscopic cases from both the VTE1 and VTE2 performance measures. So they essentially just sidestep the whole issue. They will not be looking at these patients for evaluation. However, one caveat here is that if the case is not purely laparoscopic in nature, let's say it was laparoscopically assisted but had an additional incision through which some, you know, other manipulation was done, or if the case started out as a laparoscopic case but then was converted to an open procedure, the case is then included. So those, you know, be aware of that. Now, before I actually get into some of the individual recommendations, I want to quickly go over the grading scale, and this can be rather dry, so I'll try to do this painfully quickly, I hope, painlessly quickly, I meant to say. There are really two components of the grading scale. One is a number, and one is a letter. So you'll see them all as either 1A, 2C, whatever. The number reflects the benefit-risk ratio. Any recommendation that has a 1 should essentially be done across the board because there's tremendous benefit compared with little risk. It's sort of a universal recommendation. Any number that says 2 means that the benefit-risk ratio isn't quite so clear, so that you're in a situation where individual patient circumstance or whether it be clinical scenario or patient preference might sway your opinion one way or the other. So you need to be... you need to use some more clinical judgment, perhaps, in 2. But neither of those really goes to the heart of the strength of the evidence, and that's what the letters do. A, B, C, or C plus are the 4 gradings. Here, it seems a bit counterintuitive. A is the strongest grading, followed by a C plus, followed by a B, followed by a C. And that's important because you'll see a lot of 1 C plus recommendations, and those are strong recommendations. C plus... is still strong. I'm going to skip the next slide. You can read it at the next slide or two. I think they describe in more detail, if you're going through 1A, 1B, 1C, and 1C+, exactly what they mean. But we could get bogged down in details, but I have it there really for your reference. But I do want to skip to the last slide because I think it summarizes how to interpret these. If you're at a 1A, 1C+, or a 1B, that's a strong recommendation. If you're at a 1C or a 2A, that's really of intermediate strength. 2C plus and 2B are weak, and 2C is very weak. And again, on those two slides that I sort of skipped over, you'll have a lot of description as to what different kinds of methodologies each of these different letters refer to, and I'd be more than happy to answer questions after the presentation on that. But I want to move on to the specific recommendations. And I want to start with general surgery. In general surgery, VTE risk is influenced by underlying patient risk factors, as it is in most surgeries. Age, obesity, cancer, and prior VTE are some examples of high risk factors. In addition, the type of anesthesia the patient gets can influence the risk of VTE. Epidural anesthesia, for example, has a somewhat lower risk than general anesthesia. the type and duration of surgery. We're, of course, looking at surgery by type, but duration, you'll see, is very important in general surgery because the duration has something to do with the risk level the patient gets assigned. The ACCP guidelines recommend the routine use of thromboprophylaxis following major general surgical procedures. So all major general surgical procedures need to be prophylaxed. The options that have clearly been shown to reduce both DVT and PE in general are the heparins. Mechanical prophylactic methods appear to reduce DVT rates and should be considered for patients with a high risk for bleeding. And specifically in cancer surgery patients, prolonged prophylaxis with low molecular weight heparin for 2 to 3 weeks after discharge appears to reduce the incidence of DVT. For general surgery, really both unfractionated and low molecular weight heparin have similar efficacies as well as similar complication rates. There isn't a strong necessity to choose one over the other. When unfractionated heparin is used, it should usually be used with both a pre-op dose given 1 to 2 hours prior to surgery, followed by 5,000 units, either BID or TID, depending on patient risk, until ambulation or discharge. Higher doses of low molecular weight heparin appear to have greater prophylactic effect, but also cause greater amounts of bleeding. And again, what to choose? Do you choose unfractionated heparin or low molecular weight? There's some evidence that low molecular weight may result in fewer asymptomatic DVTs, but to the extent that these are asymptomatic, it's unclear whether this is a really great clinical significance or not. We may all know the advantages of low molecular weight heparin and much simpler to give. You just give a fixed dose once a day subcutaneously and you're done. I mean, that is much simpler than giving IV continuous infusion unfractionated heparin where every few hours you have to draw a PTT and you have to readjust the rate and you have to worry about overshooting or undershooting and, you know, just constantly being worried about those details. And also, low molecular weight heparin gives you a lower risk of heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, which is a devastating complication that can be fatal. All of that, though, has to be balanced with the increased cost of molecular weight heparins. And in terms of cost effectiveness, there are studies on both sides of the line. Some studies will suggest it's cost effective to use low molecular weight. Some will say no. So that's one of the reasons why, for general surgery, the guidelines here don't really pick one over the other definitively. These are the formal recommendations for general surgery then. The only group that gets early ambulation only are the low-risk general surgery patients. It is difficult to get into the low-risk group. In order to be low-risk, you have to have be less than 40 years of age, and you have to be undergoing a minor procedure, and you have to have no additional risk factors. Very, very small numbers of people will be so low risk that they'll fall into this category. But for those who do, for, you know, a 28-year-old person getting a herniorrhaphy and has absolutely no risk factors, let's say, and, you know, the surgery is very quick, early ambulation alone is all you need. However, if you're anywhere else other than that, you're already in the realm of needing some kind of anticoagulation or treatment. And the next rank up is moderate risk general surgery patients, and these are anybody who's between the age of 40 to 60, even if it's minor surgery and there are no risk factors, or anybody undergoing a major procedure less than 40 years of age with no additional risk factor. They get low dose unfractionated heparin, 5,000 units BID, or the lower dose of low molecular weight heparin, which is under 3,400 international units once a day. High strength of recommendation. Next slide just briefly lists a bunch of risk factors. There are probably many more clinical ones as well. The next rank up is the higher risk general surgery patients. And these really are going to be the bulk of the patients, I think, that we're going to be abstracting and CMS is collecting. These are patients who are over the age of 60 years, even if they're undergoing non-major surgery, and have no additional risk factors. So anyone in the Medicare age group automatically becomes a higher risk general surgery. And even for the younger patients who are over the age of 40, from 40 to 60, anyone in that group who's undergoing major surgery or has any additional risk factors falls into this higher risk surgery group. These patients get their the same modalities as the moderate risk, but bumped up. So unfractionated heparin is given here 5,000 TID, and the low molecular weight heparin is given at the higher dose, greater than 3,400 international units. Again, strongly recommended. And for the very, very highest risk, patients with multiple risk factors and have all these other major surgery and advanced age, it is recommended to add on mechanical methods as well as these higher risk heparin doses. For general surgery patients who have high risk of bleeding, use mechanical prophylaxis at least until the bleeding risk decreases, and then you can start systemic anticoagulation if it's still indicated. And for selected high-risk general surgery patients, including those who have major cancer surgery, use post-discharge prophylaxis with low molecular weight heparin. I'm just going to mention very quickly vascular surgery, although it's not in the CMS category, to give you a little insight as to why it's not. Most patients undergoing vascular surgery are already receiving some antithrombotic therapy to begin with, because that's generally part of trying to prevent the restenosis, and most of these are bypass. Aortic procedures may confer a higher risk. There are a limited number of randomized control trials, and the formal recommendation basically is that clinicians not routinely use thromboprophylaxis, as in the sense that there just isn't enough evidence to suggest that it is routinely indicated, unless there are major procedures done in patients who have additional risk factors. So someone who's having a procedure involving their aorta, like an aorto-iliac bypass, who may have advanced age and other kinds of thrombotic risk factors, should get a heparin preparation. Moving along then to gynecologic surgery, the risks in general are similar to general surgery because the procedures are similar. The pelvic cavity is not far from the abdominal cavity, so you're dealing with basically clinical scenarios that are quite comparable. However, gynecologic surgeries are different. There are additional considerations. As, if you think about it, many of these patients are cancer patients. Many of the procedures that GYN surgeons do are hysterectomies, oophorectomies for the purpose of removing tumors. Many of them are malignant. So you deal with cancer, you're dealing with the presence sometimes of pelvic radiation, chemotherapy, sometimes venous compression due to tumor mass. Patients with cancer appear to respond differently to anticoagulation, which influences the choice of treatment. So the ACCP guidelines stratify gynecologic surgery accordingly as to whether the patient has benign disease or malignant disease. There are differing recommendations on that basis. The formal ACCP recommendations then for brief benign disease, early ambulation only. For laparoscopic cases with additional VTE risk factors, remember without there wouldn't be any recommendation, but with additional VTE risk factors, use either any type of mechanical or systemic that you want. However, for all major gynecologic surgery, some prophylaxis should be given. Now, here's where the stratification happens. For major surgery with benign disease, unfractionated heparin BID or the lower dose of low molecular weight heparin or IPC from the pre-op period through ambulation is recommended. Now, compare these with the recommendations for malignant disease or for higher risk patients. Similar modalities, but higher, but more intense. So here, unfractionated heparin is recommended TID, low molecular weight heparin is recommended at the higher dose, and now rather than just continuing IPC through ambulation, IPC should be continued until hospital discharge. In addition, another recommendation is the use of combined heparin with mechanical prophylaxis. Urologic surgery considerations. Patients with urologic surgery often have advanced age, multiple risk factors. Prostatectomy is a major factor for bleeding. The thing that hampers the ACP here is that there's really very limited data on the effectiveness of the comparative effectiveness of one type of VTE prophylaxis versus another. Much of the data is old. the methodological quality is poor, and most of the evidence really addresses open procedures. Very few of the studies look at TURPs or the less invasive procedures. So here the recommendations come out to be that TURP patients need to have only early ambulation, but when you're talking about the major open procedures, they should receive unfractionated heparin, BID or TID, but acceptable alternatives include IPC and or stockings or low molecular weight heparin. So you can see here what they're doing is they're basically saying that the weight of the evidence for major procedures is that probably unfractionated heparin is the best, but there have been not enough studies to really rule out the possibility that IPC, stockings, and low molecular weight heparin could be just as good. So they really accept anything here. Patients with active bleeding or high risk of bleeding should receive the mechanical prophylaxis, and the highest risk patients should get combined therapy with both mechanical and systemic anticoagulation. Orthopedics is actually interesting. Major ortho cases are at unusually high risk for VTE. DVTs are 50% or above. Proximal DVTs, which are the most dangerous that can embolize, are as high as 30% at 7 to 10 days. In general, for elective surgery, unfractionated heparin is generally inferior to low molecular weight heparin. So this is an exception to what we've seen so far in terms of recommendations. Also, the ACCP recommendations place a preference of avoiding bleeding over preventing asymptomatic venographic DVT. So they, wherever they make a decision, they try to err on the side of caution to avoid complications. For total hips, they recommend low molecular weight heparin, fondaparinux, or warfarin, all as being acceptable. Most evidence suggests that low molecular weight may result in fewer DVTs, but at the cost of higher bleeding risk, and the similar story for fondaparinux. The formal recommendations for elective total hip is the use of either low molecular weight heparin at high risk dose, started either pre or post-op. And here it doesn't really make a whole lot of difference. There's no real good evidence to suggest that you really should do it pre-op, although theoretically you'd think that it might be beneficial to prevent the formation of DVT. It hasn't really shown to be of any practical use to give it pre-op versus post-op. You can give it at half the high-risk dose, start 4 to 6 hours post-op, and then advance to full dose. Give fondaparinux, 2.5 milligrams, start 6 to 8 hours post-op, or adjust to dose warfarin, begun either pre-op or on the post-op day after surgery. All of these are grade 1A. Total knees. Consideration here is that, well, it's interesting in a way that DVT is more common with total knees than with total hip, probably because of local factors, so that even when you use anticoagulation, you generally cannot eliminate the risk of DVT. What you're really trying to do is eliminate the risk of PE and death, which of course makes sense. Unlike hip arthroplasties, IPC appears effective in total knee arthroplasties. But very importantly, it really must be used correctly. It must be, you know, put on all the time and applied properly. And perhaps the relative benefit of low molecular weight heparin over warfarin is even greater than for total hip. The formal recommendations that the guidelines come out with they look fairly similar to hip: low molecular weight heparin, fondaparinux, or warfarin. But they also accept IPC, unlike hip. So IPC is an alternative to the above. Hip fracture surgery is also looked at as a separate category from CMS. And it's especially worrisome because of the very high rate of fatal PEs, which can be as high as 7.5% within 3 months and account for 14% of all deaths and are like the second highest cause of death in this group. Fortunately, much of this can be prevented with aggressive VTE prophylaxis, but because so many of these patients are frail, and I remember working in, you know, nursing home where, you know, patients are so osteoporotic that even turning them could result in bone fractures, and a lot of your hip fracture patients are kind of similar in their clinical situation. They're very, very frail. They're extremely osteoporotic. They have other comorbidities, and there are very often reasons that they don't go right to the OR after they have their fracture because they need, you know, stabilization. They may have coexisting sepsis. They may have metabolic derangements. If they had fractured their hip and they were laying on the ground for a while before they were found, clearly they need medical stabilization before they're ready to go to the OR. The problem is these delays increase the risk of PEs, one of the reasons why there are so many PEs in this group. So, you know, there are significant pre-op delays. The recommendations then for hip fracture surgery include many of the same ones for total hip and knee, such as fondaparinux, low molecular weight heparin, and adjusted dose warfarin. They also add on unfractionated heparin. This is the only ortho category that CMS is focusing on that actually unfractionated heparin appears to be about as good as the fractionated, the low molecular weight types, maybe because of the low body weight of these patients, maybe because they are so thin and frail. It's not entirely clear why. But they also have this recommendation that if surgery is likely to be delayed because the patient has these underlying, you know, needs for stabilization, start these heparins preoperatively. Get the patient on them, you know, as soon as possible. Use mechanical prophylaxis if there's high risk of bleeding. There have been questions about prolongation of prophylaxis. Because most symptomatic VTE occurs after hospital discharge and because routine Doppler screening does not appear to be effective, the guidelines come out to recommend that patients receive low molecular weight heparin, fondaparinux, or warfarin. I'm skipping a few slides here, so you have to kind of keep up with me because I want to try to finish in a few moments. But they should receive these methods for at least 10 days. That's grade A. But further prophylaxis should be extended for up to 28 to 35 days post-op. And here they give you the various grades of evidence for the different types of prophylaxis. But again, extending prophylaxis to 10 days and then extending it postoperatively in these groups of patients is recommended because it has been shown to have an impact on symptomatic VTE. So clinically significant VTE is decreased by prolonging these prophylaxis. And just very rapidly to go over spine surgery and neurosurgery. Spine surgery suffers from some of the same lack of evidence. We don't have too many studies. Certain factors clearly appear to increase risk, such as advanced age, malignancy. Anterior approach meaning you know doing the surgery through the abdominal cavity or the pelvic cavity, a prolonged procedure or delayed mobility, and the recommendations basically are for a variety of interventions. I won't go through them. They're just listed here, sort of a laundry list. You can take a look. Neurosurgery, general considerations here is that the VTE risk is clearly moderately elevated in these patients, and prophylaxis is clearly effective. Stockings alone do not appear to be sufficient. Because of the nature of the spaces you're working in, pre-op or early post-op low molecular weight heparin should be used, if at all, cautiously. Malignant brain tumors, it's very interesting. These appear to impart especially high risk to neurosurgery patients. So patients who have, let's say, glioblastoma multiforme, for example, very highly malignant tumors are at very high risk of VTE. The larger the tumor is, the higher the malignancy grade is, the higher the risk is. And the risk is not just postoperatively, but appears to extend over at least a year after the surgery. Other risk factors include advanced age, intracranial versus spinal surgery, the administration of chemotherapy, as well appears to be a risk factor. Leg weakness is interesting because it has been shown that if a patient has a unilateral leg weakness, you know, as a focal neurological finding, let's say, because of a tumor, that the leg in which the patient is weaker is significantly more likely to be the leg that has the DVT. It certainly makes clinical sense, but it's clearly been shown. So, you know, any kind of loss of motor function is highly significant in these patients, and lengthy procedures as well. So the CMS recommendations then for neurosurgery include that all major neurosurgery patients should undergo some form of VTE prophylaxis, but for intracranial neurosurgery, use only the mechanical methods, IPC with or without the stockings, because of all those high risks for intracranial bleeding. Alternatives could include low-dose unfractionated heparin or postoperative low molecular weight heparin, depending upon the clinical setting, and for the highest risk patients, use both combined prophylaxis with anticoagulation as well as mechanical methods as well. I'm done pretty much with my overview. I just want to mention that there are other areas covered by the ACCP prevention guidelines as well. They talk about other clinical scenarios, including surgical scenarios of trauma, spinal cord injury, and burns, and medical, including general medical admissions, cancer patients, and critical care. But I did want to leave some time for questions and answers, and also wanted to introduce a special guest that we have on the call today. I greatly appreciate him lending his time to us this morning. Dr. Stephen Cohen is the chief of the Division of General Internal Medicine, as well as the director of the Medical Consultation Service that focuses on the pre-op surgical patient. He is a full clinical professor of medicine at SUNY Downstate. Dr. Cohen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Dr. Cohen will help answer some clinical questions that might arise. Dr. Cohen's area of a great interest is in prophylaxis for the hospitalized patient. Tyrone, can we open up the call for questions and answers at this time?
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment at this time, please press the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. And once again, if you have a question at this time, please press the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. And our first question is from Elizabeth Calora from Winthrop Hospital. The line is open.
Hi, this is Shanna, clinical pharmacist from Winthrop University Hospital. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Okay.
I have a question for Dr. Stimbler. I'm just wondering, the ACCP guideline we're talking about today, is that the 2004 or they have a more recent, the 2006 one?
It is the 2004 guideline.
Oh, it is the 2004. Okay. I just want to make sure I have the updated one.
The new guidelines are usually we're coming out every 2 years, they've been delayed a little bit. I don't know if they'll be out at the end of this year or sometime in 2007.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Our next question is from Cindy Pigno from St. Charles Hospital. Your line is open.
Hi, Dr. Cohen, Dr. Stimler. It's Dr. Smith, the medical director. I was wondering if somebody could comment on indications for DVT prophylaxis for C-section and or pregnancy. I know there have been some articles that have discussed that if there's a prior history of thromboembolism or antiphospholipid antibody syndrome or other predisposing factors, maybe protein C, protein S deficiency and stuff like that. But how about routine C-section or complicated C-section and even general pregnancy?
Dr. Cohen, I might.
Okay. Well, there's a little bit of controversy about that because the OBGYN people tend not to give prophylaxis. And I think their society recommendations are not clear that the patients need prophylaxis for the routine C-section. I typically would like to look at C-section the same way as I would other surgery, except that it's very short. It's usually a 15-minute procedure or so, and the patients are usually under 40, in which case they theoretically wouldn't need anything, but they do have that additional factor of pregnancy. Anybody who's had any kind of other risk factors, I believe, should get prophylaxis, and either should get prophylaxis sometime during pregnancy, if they've had other risk factors, or certainly get it at the time of the C-section. But this is not a clear-cut recommendation by anybody.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Mary Crittenden from Benedictine Hospital. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. I have Sal Morano, Director of Pharmacy here at the hospital. He has a question.
Yeah, I was just wondering your comments on, we occasionally see aspirin used for prophylaxis in lieu of heparin or low molecular weight heparin. I just want your comments on that.
I'd like to take that one. There's a recommendation that aspirin should never be used for any patient as sole prophylaxis. It's minimally effective and certainly less effective than any of the other things we're recommending. It can be an add-on for hip fracture surgery and things like that, but should never be used alone.
Thank you.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. I show no questions at this time.
Thank you, Tyrone. Although, Dr. Cohn, I know you don't have any prepared remarks, I was just wondering if you felt you wanted to add anything to what I had presented.
I'll make a few comments. First, on the orthopedic side, I believe that there is strong evidence that a lot of these DVTs and PEs that occur after the patient's discharged from the hospital, and I believe that people should get extended prophylaxis that are going for hip replacement and probably hip fracture surgery, a little bit less so for knee replacement. And the reason for this has been that when they looked at when the incidence peaks for people getting VTEs for hip surgery, it's between 2 and 3 weeks after the surgery. For knees, it's about 7 to 10 days. That's why it's not as strong a recommendation for knees. But if you look at most of the major joint places in the city, joint disease and special surgery, they're routinely giving all these patients extended prophylaxis. On the other hand, the studies were done with low molecular weight heparin, actually with enoxaparin. However, most people wind up going home on Coumadin, but it seems to be reasonably effective. So I think that that's one takeaway point for the orthopedic people. The second thing is that we just need to routinely risk stratify everybody, medical and surgical patients, when they come into the hospital and see if there's any changes as they're in the hospital. For example, any changes in renal function or anything else that may predispose them to increased bleeding or changing the dose. DVT prophylaxis is effective in reducing things about two-thirds, about 60 to 70%, but it does not eliminate DVT completely. But again, it's the best thing that we have to offer the patients, and I think it is a high on the list for the safety measures. The Joint Commission is also now looking at currently 10 measures. They're going to cut it down a few, I think, and start beta testing next month. They're going to pick out 55 centers across the country to pilot this for the next year. And at the end of 2007, I believe that this will be either a core measure or something that's going to be incorporated into the Joint Commission accreditation procedure. So if you're not on the case already, I would suggest that you start doing it very quickly. And that's the only comments I have to make. Thank you, Dr. Stemler.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cohn. Tyrone, I was wondering maybe we could ask once more for questions. Perhaps some people have thought of any.
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment at this time, please press the number one key on your touchtone telephone. So no further questions at this time.
Okay, thank you, Tyrone. I'm going to hand the call back up to Denise.
Thank you, Dr. Stemler. Thank you for that very informative presentation, and also thank you to Dr. Cohn for joining us for the discussion. Before we prepare to close, I just have a couple of announcements for the IPG group. For those who are interested in a continued discussion on this very important topic of DVT prophylaxis, Premier will be hosting a conference call on September 13th at 2 o'clock to discuss DTE in the inpatient setting. I will be sending an email out to the group with the link on how to register for the call, and the call is no charge. Also, I would like to advise everyone of our next conference call for our SCIP, which is going to be on Wednesday, October 4th at 10 a.m. Details regarding the topic discussion and the call-in number will follow, but I'm just advising everyone so that you can save the date. I would also like to remind those hospital teams that have not yet submitted their senior leadership report for August to do so as soon as possible, and I'd like to thank those hospitals that did submit their senior leadership reports. As you know, senior leadership reporting is an important method for your facility's senior leadership to be aware of your progress as well as your team with regards to this project. The next report will be due on September 29th, and I'll send a reminder about that as well. And lastly, I'd like to please remind everyone to take a few moments to complete the evaluation form on today's call, which was included in the materials, as it it gives us very important feedback on quality improvement activities such as this. At this time, just in case there are any last questions about the presentation or the project itself, Tyrone, can we open up the lines one more time? And if there are no further questions, then we'll go ahead and conclude the call.
Thank you. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. I show no further questions at this time.
Okay, thank you again for joining us, and have a great day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's program. This does conclude the conference call. You may now disconnect. Everyone, have a good day.